Union.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. 646-381-4866.
And now on Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to Wine Talk with Stu the Wine Guru.
Thanks. You know, speak here. Welcome to Wine Talk for today, Wednesday, February 24th, 2010. It's 7 p.m. Eastern, and I'm your host, Stu the Wine Guru, coming to you live from beautiful Coral Springs, Florida, as I always do. As you know, I will take your calls anytime during the show at 1-646-381-4860 or email me your questions at info@stewthewineguru.com. You can also go into my chat room here on the show page and chat with other wine enthusiasts or ask me or my guest any questions you like. 2010 has started off amazing for the show. I want to say thanks to all the listeners out there for getting the word out. Welcome everyone listening worldwide. I call that the power of the people meets the power of the internet. If you want to find out more about me, just Google Stu the Wine Guru. You can find the websites, videos, articles, and shows I am currently a part of. Speaking of articles and reviews, I am currently writing articles for Yahoo, Google, and The Examiner, so look for those as well. I've also made a Wine 101 video series that can be viewed just about anywhere on the internet. It's also now, the video series has been translated into multiple languages, so it's real nice. It's kind of interesting to hear yourself in different languages, or actually not really hear me in different language. You see the words that I'm saying in different languages, so it's kind of nice. And my next installment is going to be Wines of Italy. I'll review some Chianti for you, so I'm in production on that one, and it should be ready fairly shortly. Well, I have to say I am pumped about my guest coming on the show tonight. First and foremost, let me say I'm a big fan of this legendary winemaker's wine. I have mentioned his company on the show many times before. He originates from one of the two wine-producing regions I have yet to fly to and see. One was South Africa, and he resides from Australia. I say all this because in a few minutes, I will be introducing my guest tonight, who is a luminary of the wine business. But first, let me give you the lineup for the show tonight. I'll be doing things a little differently. I'm going to be going a little off format because I want to give my guest the utmost time for questions and to talk with him tonight, most of the hour. Of course, the number to call in is 1-646-381-4860, or if you're shy and you prefer the computer, email me your questions at info@stewthewineguru.com. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I have a chat room open, and you can get in there and chat amongst yourselves about wine, or ask me or my legendary guest any questions about wine. I'll check into the chat room periodically during the show and get them answered. All right. As I alluded to earlier, I have a wine business luminary, winemaker, award winner, an all-around good guy. He was in the vineyards of Barossa, Australia at a young age because of his parents having a family vineyard. So even as a young lad, he had a vision of wine. Highlights of his winemaking career include 2003 and 2006 International Winemaker of the Year, 2003 and 2006 Australian Producer of the Year, and 2006 White Winemaker of the Year. The name of the company is Peter Lehman of Barossa, and his name is Ian Hongel. Please welcome Ian Hongel to the show. Ian?
How are you, mate?
I am fantastic. I want to let you know it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on my show tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Excellent. Now, all my listeners, as you know out there, you can call in and speak with Ian or myself anytime, 1-646-381-4860. Email your questions to info@stewthewineguru.com. I'm checking emails constantly. Or get into that chat room and ask us any questions. I'll check in and get an answer for you. Okay, so let's get to it. I have lots of questions to ask, Ian. I want you to do me a favor and take me back to the beginning. You grew up in Barossa Valley, a great wine-producing area of Australia. Your parents had a wine family wine vineyard. What was it like, your earliest memories of that vineyard? Give my listeners a little idea of what it's like, because, you know, naturally, not everybody gets that opportunity, which is definitely an opportunity.
Well, we were pretty lucky. I mean, we had a lot of space, which is, I think, a bit of a privilege these days when you grow up as a kid. There was
sure.
Land to play on, and there was always the watching the process of grapes being pruned during winter, and then I guess the fever-pitched excitement of watching the grapes form and change colour, and then leading up to that critical evening when, you know, harvesters would arrive and trucks, and there'd be a flurry of activity, and you'd wake up the next morning and everything could be gone. it would be over. We also had hand pickers as well, which memories of just people sitting on mum and dad's front lawn and coming in all dirty and dusty and sort of covered in grape juice, and then, you know, disappearing off into the vineyards, and you just see hear the sound of grapes plopping into buckets and see a sort of a wave of straw hats through the vineyard as everyone's trying to protect themselves from the sun.
Now, give me an idea. How old were you at this point? I mean, I take it you've always had it, so this is your earliest memory.
We moved to the Barossa Valley when I was 4.
Wow.
And pretty well have been around wineries and vineyards all our life as a family. My father was a brewer and
oh, really?
Involved in the beer industry, and actually
yes.
moved to the Barossa Valley where he actually worked with Peter Lehman. And so
oh, really?
My relationship with this company goes back all the way through to my childhood. So after studying winemaking and working in wineries and vineyards all around the world and working in Australia in different wineries, to be able to come back home to the Barossa in 1998 was...
Don't skip forward. Wait, Ian. I want to ask you questions. You're going way ahead of me. Wait a minute. All right, wait. I'm going to stop you there. Okay, we're going to bring my listeners up to date. Okay, so, you know, I've been telling my listeners, it's kind of an interesting thing, it's a wonderful thing, in that if you've never smelled the grapes on the vine, that raisiny, sweet smell, you don't know how much you like it until you actually get a chance to be around it. You know what I mean? I mean, I think you would.
Yeah, well, I think it's, I've got 3 kids, and they just love walking through the vineyard with me. And
yeah.
You know, touching and feeling and eating the grapes, and, you know, they all get excited when they spot the first bunch starting to change colour. I've got a little Shiraz vineyard.
Sure.
You know, it's just lovely to watch them actually, see patterns of life and cycles of life change, which is, really nice.
Yeah, and, you know, and the thing I was mentioning is it's a sensory experience. It's tactile. You know, it's something that you use your nasal passages. Of course, I always say about smelling the wine and, you know, and getting in the bouquet, but it's the same thing walking through the vineyard.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because some of my fondest childhood memories, and this probably may alarm some viewers, but for Sunday roast when I was growing up, my father would always have wine, you know, we'd have it all through the week, but... Sunday, he'd often put a little bit of in glass, and, you know, you'd get to taste a little bit. It'd probably be a teaspoon of wine, but
sure.
He would put Shiraz in front of me and then Cabernet in front of me, and say, you know, smell the difference. This day, I find myself incredibly successful at being able to pick those two varieties, you know, in blind tastings. And there's just this recall you get, childhood recall,
yes,
the type of smell that makes it. And I've later learned that a lot of the food researchers and scientists will say that, you know, expose your children to as many smells and tastes as possible, because that's when the database forms for
yes,
smell recognition. And so, needless to say, our kids have a very varied diet.
That's absolutely correct, though. I have to tell you, it's interesting. Just to add to that, last week's show I was talking about the idea of being in a vineyard and smelling the you know, this raisiny smell. And I said, you know, it's kind of like you bring it back to your childhood. If no matter where you live, let's say you lived in an apartment, okay, and someone, you know, everybody cooks different things and they use different things to cook. Some use onions, some use garlic, you know, and different types of herbs. And you associate those, the people and the food with, you know, what they use, because you smelled it through the wall as you walk through and you smell the different smells. And so it's kind of like you said, the recall that you have is absolutely amazing, because you may not remember who the person was, you may not remember their name, but you can remember where they lived and what they cooked. And you probably have some, you know, some memories of, you know, doing things with their kids, you know. So, you know, some of my fondest memories are doing that, actually just thinking back on those things and who cooked what and, you know, what I smelled and where I was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I digress.
It's, it's a very powerful sense.
Yes.
It goes much further than we probably care to recognize.
Absolutely. So let me take you a little further and my listeners a little further. So you finish enology studies in early 90s and you start working at Penfold. Tell us about that experience. What did you learn from that, out of curiosity?
Well, I was working actually as a sparkling winemaker, as an understudy, straight out of college, and it was a very professional company at that time, and well, it still is, and it basically just gave you a very strong business framework to, for want of a better description, a slightly more corporate side to wine, and that at the end of the day, when you get to that scale, you know, it's about making sure that you're efficient and that you dot your I's and cross your T's.
Sure.
And that the importance of batch processing and consistency, where when you're making a wine that people have had before, that the next time they buy it, there's an expectation that there's continuity of taste. So
right.
That probably set me up for that kind of thought process.
That's great, because, you know, it's very rare, even that little nugget there. I talked to a lot of people and a lot of winemakers over the course of my years, 15 years or so, in travel. And the breaking it down the way you've broken it down really is a wonderful thing. And people get to hear, the listeners that are listening, get to hear from your, you know, your brain, from your thought process as to what, you know, what you're doing and how you're doing it and what you're learning and how you're applying it. So it's really, it's very much appreciated. And this is what it's all about. This is what I'm trying to get across to my listeners, is the education behind it. And, you know, it's very simple to grab a bottle of wine and pour it into a glass and sip it and drink it. But knowing everything behind it, not the average person doesn't get a chance to travel worldwide and doesn't get a chance to go in and talk. And so it's, you know, this is a very enlightening experience that I like to offer to everyone that listens.
The beauty of wine is there's so many angles and there's so many faces to the wine family business, the wine industry, and you know, it's every bit as relevant as the other, and you know, having a full comprehension of, you know, from the garagist style winemakers who we'll put a few barrels out of their shed to very large international companies that, you know, stake their reputation on being able to deliver a branded wine year in, year out. You know, it's very important, I think, to have a comprehension of what's at stake.
Absolutely.
It's good to have done. It's good to have been involved in all ends of it.
It is. And, you know, I tell you, the one thing that's unique and, again, wonderful about wine is that it creates a bonding experience that one that transcends all cultures. So, you know, people from all over the world.
Wine brings people to the table, doesn't it?
That's it. Exactly.
A medium for conversation. It becomes a medium for breaking bread. And I think that is one of the very special things about wine. It's more than just a drink.
It has that property. Definitely.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Shiraz. We mentioned Shiraz. It's the most well-known varietal from Australia. Probably, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, the most grown, most produced.
Most produced varietal in
most
Australia.
Okay.
Most important varietal to our region.
Absolutely. So now I go back to that little trick that your dad little test that your dad did with you. Tell me about working with that grape, your thoughts on it versus growing Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah, any other grape. Because obviously with the largest production coming from Australia, there, you know, and I have to say, I've always felt this way about things. If you're going to drink wine, and I'm not trying to say it, I like to drink it from the origin, the country of origin. For me, in other words, if I know I want to get a good Shiraz, I know I'm going to get it from Australia. If I want to get and I'm not taking anything from the Cabernet or anything else, but I'm just saying I like some of the Cabernets from Napa. I like the Bordeaux from, obviously, you know, the blends from France, and so on and so on. But what I was going to say was, since the most Shiraz is produced there, obviously there's a thought behind it as far as the terroir and the climate and all that. And I wanted you to just touch upon that versus all the other varietals.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, Shiraz has obviously grown incredibly well in Australia in terms of recognition, sales, and then as a wine itself, the types of Shiraz we produce. But I guess you get back to the basics. Why has it been so successful? And that's when you really hit on the type of climates and the soils and winemaking techniques and clones that we have. Obviously produce a wine that gathers, for want of a better description, a very high world acceptance. Shiraz makes beautiful, deeply coloured wines with incredible mouthfeel and texture, but very also high aromatics. And
yep.
Then there's all different spectrums of Shiraz that are produced, mm-hmm. But Australia produces consistently a fantastic wine that really does, I guess, hit the mark with our drinkers. And I guess it's always a saying, you can sell them the first bottle, but it's whether they come back and buy the second. And the growth of Shiraz is that, you know, what we're doing is producing a wine that really appeals to people around the world.
Right. And you do it so incredibly well. And I'm not saying you in general.
Thanks.
I'm saying you in specific.
No, I mean, there's amazing diversity in Shiraz that comes out of Australia and out of the Barossa Valley. I mean, it's a region with really two levels of altitude and a multitude of soil types, and then also an incredible heritage of a vine stock. Australia boasts the oldest living Shiraz vines in the world, still on own roots. If I jump ahead to a little bit of history, when Shiraz was planted in the Barossa Valley, it was pre-phylloxera. So the original clonal material understood to be taken from the hill of Hermitage, Tane Hermitage.
Right.
And phylloxera swept through France and essentially wiped out a lot of their original planting material. And we're still fortunate enough to be free of phylloxera in this region.
Right.
And hence have 100, 150, 160-year-old living Shiraz vineyards still on own roots from the original planting material that was taken from phylloxera in France.
That's unbelievable.
So
that's
as
amazing.
A new world, as a new world wine region, you've got the oldest vines in the world on some of the oldest soils in the world, producing these wines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's rare that people understand. I think, you know, again, the average wine consumer goes to their wine shop or wherever they purchase wine and, you know, buys a Shiraz in whatever their pocket will bear and
yep.
drinks it. And not knowing, as you were mentioning before, there are a variety of different levels of grade or quality to them, so that they distinguish themselves. And, you know, it's funny. I've gotten that on the retail end. When I worked in the retail end, I always got that question is, okay, why is this $12 and this is $40 or $60? Where's the difference between this Shiraz and this Shiraz? You know, you always get
yeah.
that. You know,
from a retail experience, the best thing I can do as a winemaker in that is an in-store tasting, and I get the exact same question. And you take people through our range of Shiraz, which goes from essentially $15 to $100.
Right.
And they say, well, why is that called 100 and that's 15? And I said, no problem, let's taste. And we go through the wines, and as we step up and they finally get to the last wine, they look at you and they go, I get it. You know, and it's, you know, it's, and I say, that's what you're paying for, you know.
Right.
It's the intensity and the complexity and the layers that involved in the higher end wines.
Right, and there are vintages. I mean, that's something to be also mentioned, in that the same thing as you have with Cabernets and you have with Bordeaux and you have with, you know, Italian Brunellos and so forth, there are vintages of Shiraz, as you mentioned before, because of the fact that the vines have, you know, have been around hundreds of, you know, over 100 years. You know, so to get a wine from produced from something like that, you know, it's going to cost a little bit more because it's going to taste a little bit better, you know, or a lot better.
Exactly. I mean, you know, just flip it around for a minute from my perspective, to be able to make wine off vineyards that have been owned for the same family for seven generations. You know, as I walk through these vineyards or I drink the wine that we've produced off these old vines, it just, it blows my mind how many people have worked that piece of earth and have pruned the vineyard or helped in the harvesting or driven a horse and cart or a horse and plow up those rows, you know,
right.
100 odd years ago. And here I am today making wine off the same living plant.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's a privilege. You know?
And you know, that's a very humbling thing to say. And in addition to that, it's got to be pretty amazing to be standing there, and like you said, and you've got to feel the history under your feet.
Yeah, it's something that we don't probably make people aware enough of. I mean, if you look at a French chateau, the history is 800 years old plus. But
right.
And that's incredible, and I've worked there, and you just smell it as you walk into the region, and you know, you know you're somewhere special. But obviously our buildings aren't that old. But our earth is millions of years old, and our vineyards are some of the oldest in the world, because the French vineyards, they turn them over, you know, at a much higher rate, and
right.
Whereas these vines are basically still kicking on, and it's incredible.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, here in the States we really don't have much like that. You know, California doesn't have that kind of history, and the more I travel.
You've got Vegas.
I'm sorry?
You've got Las Vegas.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Las Vegas. But I was going to say, you know, it's funny. The more I travel, the more I realize, you know, we're such a young country, you know. You know, I lived in Manhattan. I lived in New York. And I remember, you know, living in Manhattan and walking with a friend of mine one time. This has got to be 20-some odd years ago. And I remember looking at this one building, and realizing it said established, you know, 1899, or I'm sorry,
yep.
like something like that. And I thought to myself, wow,
yep.
that is a really old building. And then
yep.
the funny thing hit me. I went to Rome, and with my wife and I, and we went on our honeymoon. And we're, you know, typical tourists, we're walking around, you know, we're looking. And we're standing by this obelisk. If you've ever been to Rome before, there's an obelisk. It's by the Pantheon, not too far from it. And this tourist, these bunch of tourists go by, and this tourist guy turns around and points at my wife and I and says, okay, and over there, right where they're standing, It was where Caesar was stabbed by Brutus. And I looked and I said, here? Right here? And, oh, yeah. And they just kept walking. And then we thought to ourselves, wow, okay, thousands, not hundreds, thousands of years right under our feet, the cobblestones we're standing on. So, you know, like basically what I was getting at was just making the comparison between having, you know, that many generations make wine, and something that is New World technically, but from old vines.
I think what makes it special for us in the Barossa Valley is it's the continuity of a living thing. It's not just a building that was built, 500 years ago, which in its own self is an incredible fact. You know, we have eucalyptus trees, red gums, we call them, that are 500, 600, 700, 800 years old, still living, and they dot the landscape all around our region. And they might be, 20 metres around the girth. You could, they're sort of like the California
redwood
forest.
Right.
There's some amazing things here. They're really old, but the great thing is they're still living.
Now, are they protected? Or do the koalas get to eat the eucalyptus off of those?
They eat a specific eucalyptus. They don't eat these particular trees. But yeah,
I was going to say that would be a crime. It would be terrible because you'd have two things that would basically be close to being extinct. one extinct, almost extinct thing eating something else.
No fear of that yet.
Yeah. Okay, so now let me get back a little bit. I'll touch base on a few things for my listeners here. So now in 1998, as you alluded to the first couple of seconds of our conversation, you get a job at Peter Lehman. So,
yep.
Now, you started to talk about it. How did that exactly come about? I understand that your dad had worked for them, but what exactly was the impetus for that?
Lehman's is a fantastic sort of family-owned company where once people sort of join here, it's not how many years you've worked, it's generally how many decades. It's just that kind of a place.
Right.
And so there's been a very, very stable winemaking base at Peter Lehman's, and it's been headed up for the last 30 years by the current chief winemaker, whose name is Andrew Wiggin.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been with Peter since the formation of this company. And on his side was a fellow by the name of Peter Scholes, whose brother Michael actually works in the Napa as a winemaker there. But his business was growing, and it was time for him to move on. And so this rare opportunity came up where there was a winemaking position available at Lehman's. And I applied for the job, and a couple of interviews later, I found myself moving back to the Barossa Valley with a big smile on my face.
Well, yeah, and it's funny. I mentioned at the top of the show, I said, there's two places two major wine regions I have not been to. One is Australia, and the other is South Africa. I mean, I've been basically everywhere else. And, it's so rich with, like as we mentioned before, history. And it's so rich with, fantastic wines and great winemakers. And the thing that I notice is that it's very similar to the way Napa Valley is. It's a lot bigger. In that everybody, supports everyone. There isn't what I mean? It's not a competitive thing. Winemaking doesn't seem to be competitive. I noticed that. In other words, like going through Napa Valley, I went to, a couple of tastings, of course, and I got a chance to talk with the winemakers and the owners of the vineyards. And I went through and I walked through the vineyards and, had that kind of personal tour. Very lucky to do that.
Sure.
And the thing that I noticed was, I asked, I'm very inquisitive, and I ask a lot of questions. And so the questions I asked were not typical questions that is asked of a winemaker. So I remember throwing this one winemaker before. I won't mention his name at the moment. But anyway, I said to him, so what's your favorite wine? What do you like? And I was expecting him to say, of course, his own. And oddly enough, he said, a French wine. He said, it's my, And I said, well, why not your own? He said, well, wine is not a competitive sport. It's not.
Yep.
And not that I thought it was, but I was very pleased to hear an honest answer and not one of, well, we're the best and, and thump the chest, So and I find that to be everywhere I go. People talk about, oh, did you get a chance to go to here? Did you try their wine? Did you, and I think, you know, it's what a wonderful, it's like, what's the best way to put it? It's like a living on a commune, you know, of winemakers. And everyone there helps each other.
Wine is a journey. You know, wine is a journey, and to get along that pathway, that journey involves tasting as many wines from as many places in the world as you can possibly get your hands on or your lips around. Which is, I think, I've never met a winemaker that, you know, isn't more interested in wanting to try the wine at the other end of the table rather than, you know, necessarily the wine that's there straight in front of them. That, you know, and, you know, often you'll go to a restaurant here in the Barossa and you'll be sitting down and the room will be full of people that you know, and waiters will be just walking across the room taking, burying bottles between tables where everyone, take that over here and, you know, let such and such try this, you know, often something else. And the sort of the wine waiter rules aren't as strict in Australia as they are in the States. And you know, you'll just see this frenzy of glasses being you know, swirled around the restaurant. And you take one bottle and you've ended up trying 10 different wines.
It's a wonderful thing, though, I have to say. It's really, I go back to the communal idea. It definitely is. And it's a consortium.
You're sharing. That's it.
Yes.
The Barossa has an amazing knowledge base of information on the actual winemaking art and on vineyards and on the seasons and what to do in good times and what to do in bad. And people get together and they sit around and we talk about, oh, I've got this problem, you know, or this isn't working or what happened here. And everyone will just, you know, there's no fee involved. It's just, oh, hey, such and such down the southern end of the regions using this, and apparently it's worked. So, you know, try that. And
it seems to be that way. I seem to notice that, like I said, everywhere I go, not only, you know, in every region, whether it be Italy or France, or everyone is interested in helping each other because it's the common goal, you know, of fixing the problem, or, you know, so this way it doesn't happen again, you know. And, you know, if I have that information, why keep it to myself? No reason, you know. But I was going to ask, I'm just looking here to see if we have any questions. I've got a ton of email questions. You want to take an email question?
Sure.
Okay, great. So this one, you'll be happy to know. This one is from Simon 80 of Queensland, Australia.
Right.
Okay?
Yep.
And it says, I'm listening, mate, and I love your show. My question is for Ian, and I guess this basically goes back to, you know, what we just were discussing, but he says, what separates Peter Lehman Wines from the herd as a winemaker here in Australia? He says, thanks, Stu, and cheers to you both. So I want to say first, thanks, Simon, for your email question. And
thanks,
Ian, take it away.
We always feel that as a wine region and as a wine maker, you know, wine is about the people, the stories, the place that we come from, and the wines that we produce. And, you know, Peter Lehman's winery is, you know, founded by a man who's still alive.
Right.
Still alive today. And, you know, his story is continuously being told. And the fruits of his labour are now being passed on to us. And we can continue to tell that story. And we're making wines from, you know, vineyards owned by families that we've worked with now for nearly 50 years.
Right.
In Peter's past life as a winemaker at Saltram before he started Peter Lehman Wines. But these are now the grandchildren of the people
that
Peter started working with.
Yes.
So there's this inherent bond between us, the winemaker, and the grape growers or vineyards of this region. And I think that is second to none in a business model that, you know, it's done on a handshake and a trust of quality. And I think that the blessing that the Barossa gives us is incredible diversity. So we don't just make one wine. We can make an entire range of wines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great answer and great question.
Thank you to Simon for, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got a call here. It looks like we have an international call, so let me take that, if you will. Let's see.
Hello.
Hello, caller. What is your name and where are you calling from?
Max Morales from Chile, from Andes Wines.
Oh, fantastic. We've got Andes Wines on here. Ian, from Chile. We've got Max calling in. Max, welcome.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Hello, Peter. I think a couple of years... hello, I'm from Chile. I think a couple of years ago we talked by email, and I just wanted to comment that a lot of people in Chile follow you about what you're doing in Australia, and actually there's a big movement in South America trying to get into the family concept the last couple of years, and I think you are one of the people that is seeing after what you've been doing the last years.
Well, thank you. We just put so much value on it as a model, the business, and that if you get the family right, and if you get the hub in which we work within our regional community, and the relationships are respected and honoured, I think that that resonates through what we're doing, and the people who work in this company are incredibly proud of where we come from and what we've achieved as a relatively new winery in the world. We're incredibly passionate and believe about what we're trying to do. And I think that's a message that everyone who walks into a store, if you like, and when they want to buy one, they can relate to that, and they feel part of our family, especially if they've had the opportunity to visit the winery and spend time here.
That's great.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, in Chile, the last couple of years, we've been seeing on labels names of people, and that's the thing I think the market is looking for, somebody that they can call and even argue about what they found in the bottle. And I think there's a few people doing that in the world, and you can count it like less, maybe 100 people in each country, maybe less, I'm not sure, but in Chile it's about 20 people that they are launching their wine, and they have seen you and they have read about what you've been doing, and I think it's, that's the good thing about the new world, we can do it.
Hey, Max, I had a quick question. I wanted you to just give a little info quickly about Andes Wines and what you're about. I know that there's a big movement in Chile and Argentina with your company, what you do. So if you just wanted to give a quick little, tell people what you do. I'm familiar with what.
Well, actually, Andes Wines has been working and almost 10 years, and we have a team in Sydney, traveling around wine regions, and maybe in the next couple of weeks we've been calling Peter and the company to visit them.
Ian, right?
We do videos and. Of course we're going to visit you, but we've been doing a global network uniting about 15 countries, and now it's too, somehow we've been finding a way to work and open this global network, and I think this type of radio talk are marvelous, actually.
Well, thank you. Well, I appreciate you calling in and asking Ian and questions about what Peter Lehman's all about and what they're doing and their mission. And I will please call in again, and I look forward to talking with you again. Thanks so much, Max.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Have a great evening.
Bye, Peter.
Thank you.
So, again, as I mentioned, the show is international, so you get calls from everywhere. Let me go back to I do have another email if you want to grab that one as well.
Sure.
This one is from Jack Rack. Interesting name. I get some great, interesting screen names that people have. This was from Liverpool, England.
Yep.
And it says, cheers to both. Stu, I've been listening to you from your very first show, and it's first class. Well, thank you. Love your guests. My question is for Ian. How do you tell the difference between the levels of good and great Shiraz? Well, you kind of touched upon that earlier, I guess. Jack, if you were listening, but I guess Ian can just kind of touch upon that and give you an answer to that as well.
Yeah, my answer really hasn't changed from an educational perspective. Is it to perhaps get a get a group of friends together and all put some money in and go and buy a range of wines that are perhaps from the same region to try and, you know, eliminate the variables and buy a series of different wines at price points. So buy a Cabernet, buy Napa Valley Cabernet or something, or Australian Shiraz from the Barossa, and go, you know, at $10, at $20, at $30, and $70 and $100 or something like that.
Right.
And line them up, and your mouth will explain it to you better than I can. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's all in the taste.
Yeah, intensity and richness. It's you know, and that's the most practical way for a person who wants to understand what they're paying for to try and, you know, shine some light on that experience. Or, you know, if you get the opportunities to visit wine regions, you know, you'll certainly taste a lot of wines in a day, and you'll start to gain an understanding and a perspective of why the people in that particular region value these wines at a higher price to other wines, and you'll start to understand what will set you apart.
Absolutely. Great. I have to tell you that. And that was a good question, even though, I mean, you know, you had gone into it earlier. I want to touch upon something here, if you would, for my listeners. People are listening worldwide, and they have questions, right? So
Yep. If
you could explain just a little bit, for the person who has never traveled to Australia, okay, you can just give kind of like a little synopsis, a little overview as to the way the wine regions are broken out. Because, you know, I know that there are multiple wine regions. I know there's more than Barossa Valley, of course. So if you could just kind of just give them an idea, like I know about Napa and I can explain Napa, but I know a little bit of, just enough about it, but coming from you would really be something fantastic.
Sure. Firstly, the wine regions of Australia are in a belt that runs across from east to west or west to east, whichever way you want to look at it.
Right.
And within that belt, the latitude between these areas, don't ask me what the numbers are, 32 or something like that, there's a strip where the temperature and the humidity and the rainfall is a band that runs across Australia, sees most of Australia's wine regions pinpointed within this area. And that really runs from, say, you know, Sydney down to Tasmania, which is a little island below Australia, and then runs all the way across to the western side, the Margaret River and up to the Swan Valley. And there's a big gap in the middle where we have a lot of desert, but this sees good rainfall through this band, not too hot, generally cool dry winters, or cool wet winters, sorry, and generally gives us a ripening season that is generally free of a lot of the sort of diseases that are often synonymous with grape growing regions.
Right. Now you were mentioning... Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. Far away.
No, I just wanted to... I just was going to ask. Is it similar in to some degree certain areas like Argentina and Chile? I mean, in that the amount of rainfall and how that works? Are there regions, are there areas...
There's the rainfalls vary from, you know, I have to talk in millimetres, I'm sorry.
That's
but,
okay.
Probably from, you know, 350 millimetres up to probably 700-800 millimetres of rainfall. You know, that gives various regional difference between slightly wetter, cooler areas and slightly sort of dry, more Mediterranean areas. The Barossa is seen as a sort of a Mediterranean area in its climate, so it's termed as having cool, wet winters and warm, dry summers, which is basically what we've had this season.
So now, would you be in harvest at this point?
We're right in the middle of harvest, halfway through.
It's a great time.
We're having a very good vintage.
I was going to ask how it looks.
We've had lovely rainfalls in winter, which sort of sets the vines up with beautiful canopies, and the season's been relatively cool. So we've spent a lot of time in vineyards, and there's basically no sunburn, and the fruit's in very sound condition. Lovely colours in the reds, and great delicacy in the whites. So as a winemaker, 2010 is quite exciting.
So in other words, we're looking at... So when they come out in 2012,
for the red.
They will be phenomenal. You're hearing it now from the winemaker himself. Out of Australia, Ian Hongel, telling you that 2012 is going to be fantastic. As soon as you get those 2010s and 2012, hold on to them. Drink them up and hold on to them.
They'll be good. I think we've got some really nice things going on in ferment at the moment, so quite pleasing.
That's good. That's fantastic. I've got some more email here for you, just so you know.
Sure.
So the next one is from Wine Girl, G-U-R-L, from Tuscany, Italy. And she writes, you're going to like this, Ian. You two sound like a radio team. Stu, you always get great guests. My question is for Ian. I love these questions. I have to tell you, they couldn't have been better if I wrote them myself. It's great. My question is for Ian. Ian, what other grape varietals are big out of Australia, and where can I get your wines here in Tuscany? Okay, so it's a good question. I'm just going to thank her. Thank you, Wine Girl, for your email. Ian, your answer?
Well, in our region, the biggest grape is Shiraz.
Right.
But we also produce Semillon, a white grape, and Riesling from in the high hills above the Barossa Valley. And we also, the old traditional varieties of Mourvedre and Grenache are also grown.
Yep.
Then we also have some Cabernet and a little bit of Merlot. There's some interesting new varieties, but they're all still very small at the moment. Things like Albarino, Verdecchio, just to name a few, Sangiovese.
Great, you're getting into different regions varietals.
Yeah,
great.
I mean, that's probably one of the great things about making wine in Australia is there aren't a lot of rules as far as what you can and can't plant. Try things, and if it works, fantastic. If it doesn't, they pull it out and try something else.
There you go. Yeah, that's the nice thing about it.
Our wines are available in Italy, but I'll be play the ignorant hand as being just a winemaker. I couldn't actually tell you where.
So what I will do for you, Ian, of course, as a good radio show host that I am, I will give all the information as to they can go onto your site and find out about ordering it through there.
Thanks.
So,
yeah.
Here's my question for you. Ian,
go on.
Are there any upcoming projects or events that you would like to tell my listeners about? Anything? Anything you want to, get out there and plug, please, by all means.
Well, we're really excited about Riesling as something sort of quite different, and people probably don't think of Australia as a Riesling-producing region. And I think that we produce very dry, minerally style Rieslings
right.
that are quite awarded. But, I think if there's anything I want to tell listeners about wine from us or from Australia is that seek out something that, is probably, pull up with some friends and try to buy something extra because I think there's a wonderful message of discovery with wines from our region that, that there are some incredibly unique wines being produced and that, take the time to perhaps go one better than you may have originally intended and you might be surprised.
Right. Okay. Well, let me see. I've got some people in the chat room to see what's going on in there. Anybody asking questions there? I've also got some more email questions here before we wrap it up. And as everyone knows, the show goes upwards of an hour. It can go anywhere in between that time. So I kind of keep it as a loose format. And so this way, everybody gets in everything they want. The questions are asked, I'll never shut the show down if someone has a question like the last second. People go wait. I'll have somebody in our chat room and they'll ask a question. Literally as I'm saying okay, so good night. And they go wait. I think let's see. I think we got all the questions here answered because that works. Well, I have to say. It was a fantastic show tonight. It was really, really more educational and entertaining than I've had with many of my guests. You are a gentleman and a scholar. You really are great at explaining and giving and disseminating the information so that my listeners from every walk of the wine world can understand what they need to know about wine, about the region of Australia and how it grows it, and also about Peter Lehman. The thing I wanted you to also mention before we, you know, kind of cut this short, if you would just give everybody like a little clue in about Glen Curlew and Bodega Colome and,
sure.
and Hess, if you would, because, you know, they're part of it.
So the Peter Lehman is, I guess, under an umbrella of what's called the Hess family of wines. And within that, we have the Hess Collection Winery out of Napa, Glen Curlew in South Africa, Colome in Argentina, and Peter Lehman Wines in Australia. And these, are wineries that are small wineries with, a family feel and, are like-minded in business philosophy and that with a mission that it's not necessarily about making more, we're trying to make better. And so as a portfolio of wines, Donald Hess, who owns the group, for want of a better description, basically, you know, is quite visionary in what he's trying to take to the market and to tell the story of four very unique wineries that, I think are wineries that really do exemplify the regionality of where they come from. And so, it's really quite exciting to be part of something that holds that philosophy, because the worst thing that always happens to winemakers when they get taken over by bigger corporate companies is that the first thing is they want your brand and then they just want to maximise it. And so they don't care about the quality. They just go, just make me more. And, this really isn't something that's happening here. And it's nice to have that sort of sense that we have a control over our quality and our destiny.
And they're both together. They both run concurrently, basically.
Yeah, and I think that lets you make better wine. And at the end of the day, that's I think what everyone wants.
Absolutely. The amazing thing to me is that you hear about California, and lately you hear people saying that the winemakers are tending to go more towards the fruit bombs, and making Cabernets. I guess there are winemakers out there like that. And, I think in every region you might find that. But I have to say that it definitely comes down to what you put into it and the time and the effort and like you said, the end product running concurrently with your mission. What you want ultimately at the end of the day, you want the quality control to be there. So it's not just mass produced. It's not just let's get it out. And it's not let's make the taste for the people because the average person wants something sweet, let's make it the way we make it, the way we do it.
Yep.
And then and the people that will appreciate that will appreciate it. It's like, the cream rises to the top or the water seeks its own level, whichever metaphor you like to use, I think it applies.
I think one of the things that I've learned over the last couple of decades is really that there is a myriad of tastes and palates. And, people like different things, and that's okay. And it came to me quite early in my career when I was sort of saying to someone one time that, this is a terrible thing. It's too high in alcohol. It's sweet and all of this. And the person turned to me and said, well, you know what? I got about 100,000 cases of this being sold. So don't tell me what my customers like.
Wow,
I went,
right.
Okay. And I thought, and there in itself was a rule. And the great thing about wine is that there is so much diversity. And if you don't like something, you know what? Cool, because you can go out and find probably what you do like without too much effort. And there's incredible diversity. But I think keeping your mind open, the fact that some people might like something that's sweet, some people might like something that's bone dry.
Right.
Some people might like something with heaps of acidity, mm-hmm. and other people may want no oak or stacks of oak. And I think you stick to your gut. You stick to your gut. You do what you know you can do. If people like it, they'll come back and buy it, and you'll stay in business. And I
That's
guess
it.
That after 30 years, the message that you know the feedback we've got is that there are people who enjoy drinking what we do, and basically, you know, what we're offering is certainly resonating with a lot of folks around the world. So that's I think you know, we are who we are, and we're just gonna, you know, continue to just do what we do and tell our story. And if you like it, I guess you'll get on board our train. And if you don't, there'll be another one at the station.
Well, and here's the thing I was gonna tell you. The one thing that I've said to people over and over years and years and years about wine, and that is this: you can go your whole life and never drink the same two wines. That's the beauty of wine. There's so many. There's a plethora out there. There's to add to and kind of put a highlight to a verbal highlight marker on what you just said.
I reckon the world would be a lot happier if people did spend the rest of their life drinking different wines.
That's it. Is it? Think about it. Isn't that the beauty of it? I think everybody has that quest. You know, I'm always thinking that everyone thinks the way I think. I want to try everything I can try for the rest of my life, because I figured to myself, you know what? There's enough out there. And if I, you know, sure, there's things that I like that I'll drink, you know, on a regular basis because I like them and I know they're pretty much consistent. But I mean, for the most part, isn't the beauty in the journey of trying something different and learning, going, wow, I would never have tried that, but that's fantastic. Or unfortunately, conversely, where you go, woo, wow, that's really not good.
The best thing I've learned about this is that if you drink wine and you're wanting to learn about wine, you trust your palate. If you don't like it, don't drink it.
Right.
You know, if it doesn't resonate with you, don't have it. Move on and try the next wine.
Exactly.
Because it's a very personal experience, and I can't tell you what you'll like. And that's why when people say to me at a tasting, "Oh, I don't like that one," I think that's okay. I respect that. That's fine.
Sure.
Try this one, and then they go, "Oh, I like that." And so, well, there we go.
No one takes it personal, and everyone's palate is different. And, you know, that's the one thing I've always had fun doing, especially when I worked on the retail end, was getting keenly adept, as I call it, at learning people's palates and being able to make recommendations to them that they could count on day in, day out, and say, you know what, if you recommend it, I know I'm going to enjoy it when I drink it. And I think it kind of extends via the internet for me to this show. And that's what I ultimately want to do. I want to expose people to different winemakers and different wine-related companies so that they can say to themselves, you know what, I probably never would have tried it, or I've heard of it, but I never tried it before. You know, now I'm going to go out and try that and see what that's all about. And if I get that accomplished, I'm happy. Because I can't guarantee anyone's going to love something, but I do guarantee that if they try it, it's going to be a different experience than they've had before.
That's it. People say to me, you know, what's your favorite wine that you produce? And I say, well, they're all like children, you know.
Right.
At different times of the day, they have their place. And, you know, I don't have a favorite wine. I have different occasions for different wines. You know,
different
I think
mood,
that's a great
book. Different
great
mood and different food. That's it.
Yep.
So here's what I got. Here's what I got. For more information about Ian Hongel and Peter Lehman Wines, go to the website www.peterlehmanwines.com.au. That will bring you to the direct website. And you can click on there and you can find out about the wines and buying everything that you like. You can also find out a little bit more about Ian if you like, and email him. You can go to my website as well at www.stewthewineguru.com and click on the link of all my wine articles, videos, and listen to the archived wine talk shows. Ian, I can't say enough. You were fantastic. I really enjoyed having you on the show. I hope to have you on again. And as I always say, if it's time to pour the wine, it's time for Stew the Wine Guru. Drink up, good night, and good wine.
Thank
you again, Ian.
Much.
Take care.
No problem.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And now on Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to Wine Talk.